Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Sagarai Sumati Bhakti Vanta Swami Tanami Namaste Saraswati Devi Vrayam Vachami Vasisa Sumani Paskatari Sitari Nevan Deham Shri Guru Shri Utah Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shri Sri Rukam Sagarjatam Sagarai Vadirakam Vitam Samsajivam Sagaritam Sagaritam Vajina Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lavita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shri Jai Jai Shri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda
Jai Jai Shri
Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda Jai Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhaktavinda Jai Jai Shri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda Jai Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhaktavinda Jai Jai Shri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda Jai Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhaktavinda So it's June 17, 2016 in Zagreb, Croatia. We're reading from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, Chapter 5. Text 59-60. Okay, so this is chapter 5, text 62. Maya amse, to the other portion of the material nature. Kahi. I say, Tade, unto her, Nimitta Karana, immediate cause, Sehanahe, that cannot be, Yate, because, Kartahetu, the original cause, Narayana, Lord Narayana. Translation, the Maya aspect of material nature is the immediate cause of the cosmic manifestation. But it cannot be the real cause, for the original cause is Lord Narayana. So this section where we have the description of the relationship between nature and the Lord. And, you know, there's many times people are glorifying nature. Yes? How beautiful nature is, how amazing nature is. And actually just my daughter-in-law posted a picture yesterday on the internet of being in the Grand Canyon at the United States, how amazing nature is. And I was thinking, what is our relationship with nature? Because here, this series of verses is talking about how nature is the immediate cause, but beyond that cause is God. So when sociologists look at religions, they generally divide them into two categories, world-rejecting religions and world-embracing religions. So religions either say nature is just false or illusory. We have this word maya on the say, maya meaning an illusion, and we don't have anything to do with the world. Or the world is wonderful and it's here for us to enjoy by the grace of God. And these are generally the two tacks taken by religions. Just like when we were driving here yesterday in the bus from Split, so my phone would keep showing me what were the nearby attractions. And when we were up in the mountains, some of the attractions were monasteries. I don't know if they're still active monasteries. And at least formally, I mean, now there are still a few left, but at least formally, particularly in Europe, there would be Catholic or Eastern Orthodox monasteries and convents where people who were really serious about God would go away from the world. Yes, there's one famous monastery, I can't remember exactly where it is in Europe, but it's up on a cliff. And the monks never go out into the world. They have a little door in the bottom of one of the floors. And once a week, they lower a bucket through the floor, and some local villagers put some supplies in the bucket, and they bring it up again. Right? Or there's another monastery in Europe. I remember we had a film on this at Bhaktivedanta College, where the monks don't speak at all. They don't even use hand gestures. You may know that sign language was originally developed by monks who took vows of silence. So they don't even use sign language. They simply do not speak, except for their prayers. They get together and they say their mass together. And then they just go to their little rooms and they do their jobs in complete silence, without any communication whatsoever. Someone just comes by and brings them their meals, etc. But once a week, they go outside. I think it's on Saturday or Sunday. They go outside for 1 or 2 hours and play games, and then they can talk outside of the monastery. So those are world-rejecting religions. And then you have, and even for the laity in such religions, they're often told to be very austere. Right? And we have people like the Anabaptists, the Amish, the Mennonites, where they won't have buttons on their clothing. They have no buttons, they have no zippers on their clothing, only pins. And they don't use electricity, and they don't use telephones. And they don't use bright colors in their clothing. They won't wear even wedding rings, no jewelry. So they're, even though they're householders, it's not a renunciate-based religion. They don't have a renounced order in those religions. But still, it's a very much world-rejecting religion. And then you have the world-embracing religions. There are religions that tell you, and it can be the same religion, it can be a different group of Christians, for example. So there are Christian ministers who say, yes, God wants you to enjoy the world. God wants you to be rich. God wants you to be famous. God wants you to be, beautiful and so forth. And they will have, here's how you pray to God to enjoy the world. And they measure your piety by how materially successful you are. So you're a really pious Christian if you have this big house and you have big cars and a fancy television and so forth. And they'll even have prayer sessions where you pray for wealth, you meditate on wealth. And they have these huge, what we call mega churches, where they get hundreds of thousands of people. And people are attracted to the ministers because they're wearing fancy jewelry. So the Amish, they're not even wearing a wedding ring, and these ministers, they're wearing a huge jewel and so forth and so on. So it's interesting that both of these positions can be supported by Shastra. They can be supported by the Bible, and they can also be supported by our Shastra. You'll find quotes in the Bible saying, it's harder for a rich man to enter heaven than for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. But you'll also find many quotes about prosperity. And frankly, it's the same in our scripture. Krishna is saying that he gave the demigods along with items for sacrifice, and we should offer sacrifice to the demigods, and therefore we should be happy in this world. Yes. And there's many places also where Srila Prabhupada talks about that there should be happiness and prosperity in that a really Krishna-conscious government, a really Krishna-conscious society, would also be a society of material prosperity. That in former yugas, when people were God-conscious, prosperity was effortless. That especially in the Satya Yuga, the weather was always nice, that there was no need for agriculture, the earth just produced fruit trees and produced vegetable crops. People didn't need to spend their time. I suppose you had to make your own clothes still. But you didn't have to spend your time in agriculture. At the very beginning of Satya Yuga, there wasn't even the varnas. There were no varnas. Because there was no need for a government, so you didn't need kshatriyas. And there was no need for labor, you didn't need shudra. There was no need for agriculture, you didn't need vaishyas. And basically everybody was considered hamsa. People just engaged in meditation. They engaged in meditation and they just took the food that was naturally available and so forth. And the whole world was basically like a much higher planet. Even Srila Prabhupada went to Hawaii and he said Hawaii is left over from the previous yuga. And in Hawaii you can easily live without a shelter. It's always warm. And again, everywhere you go there's fruit trees growing and you can bathe in the ocean and in the rivers. We have, Hawaii has the biggest homeless problem of the whole United States. Why? Because it's very easy to live homeless there. You know, why have a shelter? You don't even really need a tent. So we have that idea, and then we also have many places in the scripture where Sukadeva Goswami is saying, you know, why get even a pillow? He says, just use your arm. He says, why get clothes? Just go to the garbage heap and find somebody. He didn't even have any clothes. He said, why have a house? Just go to the caves of the mountain. Why do agriculture? Just pick the fruits from the tree. So you have this extreme renunciation also in the Shastras. And you have persons like Rishabhdev and Jed Bharat, who had nothing to do with the material world at all. I mean, Jed Bharat wasn't even bathing. So he made no effort to take care of his body when his stepbrothers engaged him in guarding the fields. He would eat whatever they gave him, even if it was worm-eaten cakes. So we have these two perspectives in the scripture. One is this world negating and one is this world embracing. But both of these perspectives have serious problems with them. First of all, if you try to have a whole society that's world negating, then you're not going to facilitate many different kinds of people's desires. Like if you look at the Amish and the Mennonites, they lose a fourth of their children because they don't have anything to engage people of certain natures. There's just no place for them. But the main philosophical problem with being world-negating is that the world is the energy of God. And you're therefore negating something that belongs to God. Srila Prabhupada talked about that if a person makes a very nice garden and you go to that garden and just say, this is all false, then the gardener, he said, will become very depressed. I think about anything that we do. You know, so you guys are starting to cut up vegetables. And if I say, this vegetable cut up has no meaning, there's no value to it. It's just a false activity. So then you'll say, well, why should I do it? Right? What is the point? I mean, people engage in false and meaningless activities as a kind of recreation. Yes, people do that all the time. They do something that's completely false and meaningless, just as a kind of relaxation. But if you said to someone, everything in your life is false and meaningless, and then they'd just be depressed. And Prabhupada said, don't depress Krishna by telling him that the world is just false. So if you just renounce the world, then you're negating a large part of Krishna's energy. And then the problem with embracing the world is that then we see, so when you reject the world, you don't see it in relation to God. When you embrace the world, you also don't see it in relation to God. You only see it in relationship to yourself. In fact, we could say both of these ways of looking at the world only see it in relationship to ourself. If I renounce the world, then I just see, oh, the world is troublesome for me, therefore I shouldn't have anything to do with it. If we embrace the world, we're saying the world is enjoyable for me, therefore let me go and enjoy it. But neither one are really saying, seeing things in relationship to God. Also, each of them is very hard to maintain. So maintaining a renunciation of the world is very difficult because anandamaya vyasat, we're pleasure-seeking by nature. And unless we have very strong spiritual pleasure, then what will happen is cheating. People will appear to renounce the world and secretly they'll be doing something else. And embracing the world is also problematic, again, because we're anandamaya vyasat, we're pleasure-seeking, and the world is not very pleasurable if you embrace it for sense gratification. Is basically frustrating. So, you know, one becomes simply angry. Materialistic people go back and forth. It's called bhoga tyaga. They enjoy, they renounce. They enjoy, they renounce. They enjoy, they renounce. And in fact, without renunciation, material enjoyment is not pleasurable. So, if you had pizza for breakfast, pizza for lunch, pizza for dinner, pizza for breakfast, pizza for lunch, pizza for dinner, pizza for breakfast, pizza for lunch, pizza for dinner, it would become boring. And after a while, it would not only become boring, it would become repulsive. You know, know, you need to get away from it for a while. I mean, I find it interesting living in Hawaii because people come there for vacations. You know, you tell people you live in Hawaii, they're like, wow. But when people actually live in Hawaii, they become bored. Oh, just ocean and ocean and ocean and ocean and palm trees and palm trees and palm trees and coconuts and coconuts and coconuts and coconuts. And then they want to do something else. Now, this is just, you know, the nature of the material world, this bhoga tyaga. But neither one of these is a stable position, and frankly, neither one of them is a spiritual position. So our Krishna consciousness is quite different. And when sociologists study Krishna consciousness, they're very confused. They can't figure out if we're world rejecting or world embracing. And I think even we in the Hare Krishna movement can't figure it out either. We seem to really have a problem with this. You know, in the early days of the movement, we were definitely very world rejecting. You know, we all lived in ashrams, and we all lived extremely simply. Even the families lived extremely simply. Prabhupada would say, oh, how nice, the families don't even have any furniture. And we didn't. I mean, we really literally did not have any furniture. I remember my husband and I had one rocking chair. That was the beginning, middle, and end of our furniture. So, you know, if we're sleeping, we just slept on the floor. And now you go, almost every temple there's beds. You know, when I joined it, there were no beds. You slept on the floor, and in the morning you rolled up your bedding and you washed the floor. But so we very much appeared to be world-rejecting. At the same time, Prabhupada was in very much wanting us to start a society. And Prabhupada was talking about how a Krishna-conscious society would also be prosperous. So now we went sort of in the other direction, that we started really encouraging people to make money, especially for practical reasons, because at first we were supporting our temples by selling incense. We had an incense factory, and then we were selling books. And now we mostly support our temples through the donations of the congregation. So we want the congregation to make money, otherwise they can't give any donations to our temples. So we've started encouraging people, you know, yes, start a successful business and have a successful job. We don't usually tell people anymore. If someone says, you know, well, I have a great job as an advertising executive, you know, and I'm making 150,000 euros a year. So we don't usually say to them, oh, well, that's just terrible. You know, why are you doing that? But, you know, in 1972, that's what we would have told them. We would have said, oh, how materialistic you are. Now we said, oh, very nice. Why don't you donate to the TOVP in my career? So we're not quite sure where we are also. We tend to sort of swing back and forth between this bhoga tyaga, frankly, in the name of spirituality, but it actually is materialistic. And going back and forth between bhoga tyaga. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur talks about this mentality in terms of the neophyte devotee. He talks about different symptoms of the beginning devotee, and one of them he calls indecision. And this indecision can be understood in several ways, but one of them is being absorbed in this bhoga tyaga. Should I get married or should I be a renunciate? Should I stay in my home or should I go to Vrindavan? You know, it is, and focusing on this as if that is spirituality. So the neophyte has this strong focus on how do I interact with the world? Because the neophyte believes that how they interact with the world, whether they're renouncing or enjoying it, is the main indicator of spirituality. So they're constantly indecision. Now, our real Krishna conscious mentality is actually quite different from either of these. Although externally, it may look something like it. If you're a brahmachari, vanaprastha, or sannyasi, you look like you're more world-rejecting, and if you're a grahasta, you're going to look like you're more world-embracing. But really, we don't have either of these mentalities at all, if you really understand what is Krishna consciousness. So here it's explained that nature is the indicator of God. We see nature as the indicator of the presence of the Lord. And we can also understand nature as the energy of the Lord in relationship with the Lord himself, and in relationship with us. So nature as an indicator of God allows us to embrace nature without trying to enjoy nature. when we understand nature as the indicator of God, we then reject the concept of our enjoyment nature, but we embrace the concept of nature's grandeur and beauty and wonder. So, of course, nature as an indicator of God is one of the main arguments of every religion for the existence of God. The order of nature, the complexity of nature, the beauty of nature, the power of nature. That such could not have come into existence without an intelligent creator. And that's the main gist of this verse, Adi 5:62. That nature points to a cause other than itself. And Srila Prabhupada very much emphasized that devotees should have this view of nature, especially in regard to the Bhaktivedanta Institute. So this requires a different kind of consciousness. Instead of seeing nature and go, oh, this is just Maya, this is just the material world, I want nothing to do with it, or, oh, this is nature, let me try to enjoy it, we say, wow, what a wonderful creation of my beloved Lord. I mean, Prabhupada would say if you're attached to one sunset, you have to come and take birth again. If you're attached to one sweet ball, you have to take birth again. And then Bhakti Swarupa Damodar said, suppose you're attached to prasadam. And then Prabhupada said, oh, then you will go to Vaikuntha. So it's a change of consciousness. And Prabhupada would say, if we say nature, nature implies that it's someone's nature. The word nature has that meaning. Nature of whom? And nature doesn't just stand alone. Whose nature is it? And we can understand a lot about who is God by looking at material nature. So the first thing we can understand is there must be a creator and maintainer. I mean, that really doesn't take much intelligence, and it amazes me how people with seemingly a lot of intelligence can look at nature and experience nature and not think that there's someone who created it. I really can't even fathom it. Because if we take something extremely, extremely simple, let's take something here, like those curtains, they're quite simple. They're not very complicated. But there's so many intelligent humans involved in their creation. Someone had to grow the plants. Somebody had to spin the fiber. Somebody had to weave the fiber. Somebody had to produce the chemical for dyeing it, which was probably done in the laboratory rather than from plants. And then somebody had to design it. And somebody had to cut it. Somebody had to sew it. Somebody had to ship it and warehouse it. So many things. There's so many different people involved in something as simple as a piece of fabric. And if you look at it and say, well, nobody created this, you know, it would be ridiculous, really. Yeah. And it would be insulting also. Right? You know, nobody created this. What do you think of my curtain? Oh, your curtain? What do you mean your curtain? So what to speak of something infinitely more complex? I mean, if we look at the plants from which this curtain was probably created, let's say it was created from cotton. So a cotton plant is so much more complicated than the curtains. Now, every cell of the cotton plant is a living being, and each cell is infinitely more complex. There's no scientist that even understands the working of one simple cell. So to say that the curtain has a creator, but the cell in the cotton plant has no creator, really isn't logical at all. You think about archaeologists who, you know, dig up the remnants of old civilizations, and one of the things that they have to figure out is what was made by human beings and what was not. You know, is there something that's just some rock formation, or is there something that's an arrowhead? And sometimes it's a little difficult, but generally, the archaeologists are able to discern what is the work of an intelligent being. So looking at nature, we'd have to say it's the work of an intelligent being. So that's one way in which nature indicates a God. And then we'd say, well, many beings or one being. So there's been, of course, many human societies that worship simply many gods. But even in those societies, they always had a chief. There was always a head. In fact, the word Indra means the chief. That we understand that even if they're talking about many people were involved in the creation of this curtain, undoubtedly. But still, overall, there has to be someone who makes the decision that we're going to produce a burgundy-colored curtain of this. Someone has to make that decision. And we find that in all of our endeavors with which we're familiar. You know, if you rule by committee, there's got to be a chairperson of that committee. It just doesn't work otherwise. The most unstable form of governance is an equal partnership. It doesn't tend to endure. It doesn't tend to endure, which is one reason why even in a family, the suggestion is that the husband be the head of the family. If the husband and wife say, well, we're completely equal partners, the problem with that is suppose they have completely opposite and firmly held opinions on something. And it could be something as inconsequential as, you know, what to eat for dinner or what color car to get or something like that. And if both of them have equal power, then they simply won't buy the car and they simply won't eat. It just won't happen. Somebody has to give in. Now, of course, the leader can choose to give in. The leader can say, well, I voluntarily will go with what you say. But there has to be a boss. And the Yamadutas brought this up to Yamaraj when they arrested Ajamil. And they said, we thought that you were in charge, Yamaraj. But our orders from you were overridden by another authority. And we were not able to stand against them. When these persons came, we were stuck. and they took control of the situation, and they wouldn't allow us to take the soul of Ajamil out of his body. And they said, so what's going on? It looks like there's two rulers, you and whoever is in charge of these guys. Because they understood that those persons were messengers. They said, these people have a boss, and you're our boss. So it looks like there's two leaders. They said, but there can't be two leaders. They say, if there's two leaders, then they're going to disagree. And they said, sometimes people will be both punished and rewarded, or neither punished and rewarded. And how will there be order in the universe? There must be one overall authority. So nature also teaches us there must be one overall authority. So there must be some creator, some maintainer, and ultimately there has to be one. There may be many, and in fact we agree that there are many, but overall there must be one. Then something about the nature of this creator can be seen from nature. Well, we find that nature is very orderly. Right? There are seasons that come in order. There are movements of the planets that go in order. There's the life cycle of a living being that has a particular order, and there's a repeating order in things. There's certain repeating order of numbers and patterns in the universe, for example. This is something the evolutionists use a lot. Seems to be several templates for various bodies. So it's not that every single body starts from a brand new template. You know, you may produce many kinds of cars, but there's a basic design from which you make cars. So we see God, whoever is the creator, must be a very orderly person. But not simply orderly, because there's also surprises. I mean, just like a few days ago, it was 36, 37 degrees, and then yesterday it was going down to 15. So there's also, you know, today you're all, everybody here is there, at least half of you is wearing some sort of sweater or jumper or sweatshirt. Whereas, I mean, it was just a few days ago that it was so hot, we could barely function. We had to have fans, right? And, you know, we're posting fans everywhere. So, although everything's orderly, there's also surprises. There's sometimes, you know, differences in the weather, unexpected differences, or there's earthquakes, and sometimes the planets appear to move backwards. And so we see that God, although he's very orderly, he also likes surprises. He's not completely predictable, which gives us the concept that God must be a person rather than some sort of a formula. If God was just a formula or an energy or a force or some mathematical idea, then we would see only order. We would see only predictability. We wouldn't see these sorts of surprises. Another thing we see is the amazing variety of the world. And this is something that just I find astonishing. I brought this up the other day. So in this room we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, We have at least 10 different kinds of potted plants here in the temple room. And the structure of each plant is different. How could I tell there was 10 kinds? Well, by just briefly looking at them, these leaves have a very different shape than these leaves, and those leaves have a very different shape from those leaves, which have a very different shape from those leaves, which have a very different shape from those leaves. So the evolutionists want to talk just about practicality, but there's no practicality in that at all. There's no practical reason why this plant has a different shape of leaf than this plant. They both exist in the same climate. There's just no reason for it at all in terms of practicality and evolutionary theory. But we find not only is there this just incredible variety between one species and another of plants, but even on one plant. So if you looked at that one plant and you took all the leaves from that one plant, you would find that there were no two leaves that were exactly like the other. They wouldn't be exactly the same size and exactly the same shape and exactly the same color. Even people who have identical twins, they're mirror images of each other. So one of them has their hair whirling in one direction and one of them has their hair whirling in another direction. And as you probably all know, the two sides of our face are not symmetrical. So with identical twins, what's the right side of one twin's face is the left side of the other twin's face. So even with they're not fully identical. Right? And we each have our own fingerprints. So it's an incredible variety. And not only variety of living beings, but variety of inanimate objects. Each grain of sand is unique. I remember hearing one devotee who said, are you going to say each grain of sand is unique? I said, yes, it is. If you look at it under a microscope, you'd think you're looking at jewels. It's actually astonishing. If you look up on the internet, you know, close-ups of grains of sand, you're just, wow! And each snowflake is unique. And you would think, well, who cares? Why would God make each grain of sand and each snowflake different? I mean, I wouldn't if I were God. Would you? Would you bother? I wouldn't bother. Who's going to look at the grains of sand? You know, in our modern industrialized society, we try to get away from variety. We have factories and we want, you know, every car has to be identical and every phone has to be identical. I remember I was in South Africa when I was having a problem with my phone. So I went to a shop run by the company. It was an official company shop. And I brought in my phone and they said, oh, here in South Africa, that phone is different. It has the same company name and the same model number, but actually it's a little different. They said, our parts will not fit your phone. We have to order parts from America. I thought that was kind of interesting. But we like to make everything the same. But Krishna doesn't like to make everything the same. He makes everything different down to the grains of sand. So this tells us something about God, that God really likes variety, and God likes variety to such an extreme, unlimited degree that is practically incomprehensible to us. As I said, I'd be fine if I were God to make every grain of sand the same. It wouldn't bother me at all. I would have no... I'd say, who's going to look at it? You know, the little bugs crawling on the sand? Are they going to appreciate it? Who's going to appreciate it? But obviously Krishna appreciates it. It's something that he marvels at. We see also nature is very balanced. We also see that there's many varieties of enjoyments for the senses, far more than is needed to sustain life. So if we want to ask whether God is good or bad, it appears that God is evil because there's so much suffering that seems to us quite unfair. We're not able to see the relationship in most cases between some evil done and some suffering that comes as a result. There seems to be a disconnection to us. So evil beings seem to get enjoyment and pious beings seem to get suffering, and everybody suffers. We can't really figure that out. So in that way it looks like God may be evil, or God may be kind of whimsical, or God may be kind of detached. We really can't tell that by nature. But one thing we can see by nature is that God has given far, far more than is necessary for life. Like I said, the different species of plants, that's not necessary for survival. or to have apricots and peaches and plums, and that's not necessary for survival. And there's so many different kinds of bananas, you know, generally in the world that you only get a Cavendish banana, which has become a real problem because now there's a disease or bug that's attacking the Cavendish banana. But if you go to a tropical place, you find there's so many kinds of bananas. There's Williams bananas and there's apple bananas. So many. So that's also not necessary. We don't give prisoners in the jail, we don't give them, you know, so many varieties of things. We don't give prisoners in the jail flowers. You know, you'll not find any government is going to pay for each prisoner to have flowers. But God is giving us flowers, although we're prisoners. Flowers are not necessary. Many plants are pollinated without flowers, or at least without fragrant, beautiful flowers. So this is some indicator that God must be kind and God must be good, even though we don't understand the suffering in this world. So in many ways, we can see nature as the indicator of God, the indicator that there is a God and some indicator of what kind of God it is. This is the nature of God. I mean, just like you can look at someone's artwork. We went to the British Museum of Art. There was an exhibit about Vishnu. And as we're going through the museum, you see the works of the famous painters. And if you can understand something about the mentality of a painter or a sculptor by looking at what they've produced, you can understand something of a person by what books they write, by what kind of food they like to cook, right? By what kind of clothing they design. By looking at someone's creative output, you can understand something of their mentality, isn't it? So we can appreciate nature as a way for us to get to know Krishna better. How can I get to know more about Krishna? And as a way not only to know him better, but with the goal of loving him. We don't want to know Krishna better so we can exploit him better. Just like many people study human psychology so they can exploit humans. Right? And we'll design an advertisement that'll get a lot of people to buy the product and make them a lot of money, and that's why they're studying humans. So you can study human beings so that you can love them and serve them and please them, and you can study human beings so that you can exploit them. And there are people who study nature so they can understand something about God so they can exploit God. But we want to understand nature so we can know something of God so that we can love God. And then we also want to know about nature as very personally related with Krishna. So nature is one of the wives of Krishna. This earth, Bhumi, is one of the wives of the Lord. The Lord has a very intimate relationship with nature. Of course, we can say Maya Devi is the wife of Shiva rather than the wife of Krishna, but also she is considered one of the wives of the Lord. And Prabhupada explains that if, just like a husband might want to wake up his sleeping wife so that he can do something enjoyable with his wife. You know, please get up, we have a picnic today. So in the same way, Krishna wants to wake up the sleeping material energy because he has a relationship with her. She is a Vaishnavi. And she is considered the consort of the Lord. And as the consort of the Lord, then she becomes our mother. And in fact, even materialistic people talk about mother nature. Now, if you have a mother, of course, you have to have a father. Nobody has figured out how a mother can give birth without a father. As soon as a woman is pregnant, we understand, oh, she must have had a relationship with a man. So if we see nature as the wife of Krishna, as the consort of Krishna, and as our mother, then not only does nature indicate how we can know and love God and have a loving relationship with God, but also indicates how we should deal with nature itself. We're not just saying, okay, nature is just pointing to Krishna, but how do I deal with nature directly? So how does one deal with one's mother? How does one deal with the wife of one's father? I mean, of course, people deal with one's mother in all kinds of different ways, but at least ideally, how should one deal with one's mother? With great respect. One doesn't generally take the property of one's mother, at least not without one's mother's permission. I mean, I remember when I became a teenager, I would say to my mother, hey, can I borrow this and can I borrow that? But you don't just take it. You don't take your mother's money, you don't take your mother's possessions. And you try to serve your mother with love and affection. If your mother's sick, you take care of her. And you try to keep her healthy, you try to keep her happy. You have some communication with her. So this is the way that the devotee should deal with nature. And naturally, your mother takes care of you. And nor do you refuse the loving gifts of your mother. So this way, the devotee, they're not trying to enjoy their mother. It's God's wife, not mine. In fact, the concept of a man calling all women mother is this concept that if I call women other than my wife mother, then I won't have a mood to enjoy her, because the son doesn't have an exploitive mood, generally speaking, toward the mother. So we see nature as mother like that. I don't want to exploit my mother. At the same time, if my mother gives me some gifts, then naturally I will accept them in love. This is one of the reciprocations of love, not only giving gifts, but accepting gifts. But I want to accept the gifts in a way that will make my mother and father happy. Whether the gifts come from my father directly or whether they come from my mother. I don't want to use them in a way that will bring shame and unhappiness to my family. Right? If your parents give you a lot of money, so you want to spend it in a way, you don't just reject it. You don't just say, well, you know, I'm not going to take. No, we want you to have this. It's happiness for the parents to give their children things. But you want to spend the money in a way that will please them. You want them to say, oh, I'm so happy with how you spent your money. So in the same way, the devotees take whatever gifts are given directly by Krishna or whatever gifts are given to us by material nature. We don't think that, therefore, our enjoyment in ways that will not please the Lord. We don't just reject them, nor do we use them for ourselves. And then we see, as Prabhupada says, that everything is happily situated. The materialists, they see Mother Nature as an enemy because they're disobedient children. And mothers do punish their children. Mothers are not just, with their children. They can also be stern. Even Mother Yasoda, we're studying about in the Bhagavatam. She's chasing Krishna with a stick. She's tying him up. So mothers also have a duty to punish their children and to rectify their children. So the materialists see the Mother Nature like that. And if we see material nature as indicating God and as God's wife and as our mother, then our relationship with her is very sweet. And then even though on a physical, technical platform we're in this material world, we don't really see it like that. We see it as that I'm really relating with Krishna and everything becomes very happy. So any questions or comments or additions? Yes?
You said that everything is various. You said that
identical, yes.
Identical. But we have the word identical. It must be some form or something what is identical.
Just because we have the word? But the word isn't it isn't absolute. When we say two things are identical, we don't mean that absolutely. I mean, I really wonder, is it possible even to make two things that are absolutely identical, even in a factory? That would be an interesting question. I'm not sure. If you make, 100,000 screws in a factory, is each screw actually absolutely identical to the others? Would be a very interesting question.
Yes, that is a difficult.
I'm not sure. Well, it should be something we should be able to look up. Is that even possible? For example, I know that in many countries of the world, they have a standard weight and measure that they keep under lock and key. What is a kilogram? What is a meter? And there's some object that the government has locked up. Now, if every meter stick was exactly a meter, why would they bother? But they want to have this standard because they know that in general, when you say this is a kilo, this is a meter, it may not be exactly identical. But that's a very good question. Is it even possible? Or is that term just a general term? We have in every language absolute words that we very rarely use absolutely. Words like never and always and everyone and no one. We very, very rarely use those words in some absolute sense, yes?
I used to use Photoshop a lot, and there was this thing where you could draw something, and then you could take it and you could make an identical one. So is that actually identical? Or like if you looked closely at like each
I don't know. Thing? Each pixel, would it be a little different? I really don't know. That's a very good question. I don't know. I mean, it certainly doesn't occupy the identical space on your memory. So there is something different about it. So you could say things are not identical in that sense. Even if you made absolutely identical screws, they wouldn't be operating the same, occupying the same place. There's something different about them. This one's over here and that one's over there. And it's interesting, if you make a copy of a computer file, it has to give it a different name. Because it's in a different location. It'll put a 1 next to it or something. If you have two identical files that have identical names, they have to be in different, they can be in different folders. You can have a file with the same name in a different folder. But if it's in the same folder, it has to have a different name. So there's something that distinguishes it on some level. But that's a very good question. I mean, perhaps Krishna's made things so that it is actually impossible to have two things that are absolutely, totally identical.
Yeah, because then they would have to be together, and then they would have to be...
Then they are one.
Yeah.
Right. Of course, we have a very interesting philosophy. I mean, we're going to start getting our heads spinning here pretty soon. But we have the very interesting philosophy of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, which says that on one level, everything is like that. On one level, there is no differentiation. And we are all exactly one. That there is only one anything that occupies all space and all time, and everyone is that one. So we do say that, but we say that simultaneously there's differentiation. And it's called achintya because you can't make any mental picture of it. We can describe it, I just described it, but you can't picture it. It's achintya. So we tend, as Gaudiya Vaishnavism 2016, we tend to focus on the differentiation. But the oneness is also there. I mean, I've been studying Canto 10, Chapter 85. And Vasudeva glorifies Krishna. And then Krishna turns around and says, all this glorification you gave about me can also be applied to all objects and all living entities. And Prabhupada, writing about that in the Krishna book, talks about how we're qualitatively the same. But just if you look what Krishna is saying, without commentary, Krishna is talking about this absolute oneness. So there is an absolute oneness, and there's an absolute differentiation. But because they exist simultaneously, you could say there is no absolute oneness and absolute differentiation. You could say they're both relative. You could say we have a relative oneness with Krishna. We have the same qualities, but not the same quantity. And we have a relative differentiation with him because we share the same qualities. But if it's just a relative absolute and a relative differentiation, there'd be nothing achintya about it at all. That's not achintya. We're relatively the same because we're all humans and our bodies are all made of the same elements, and that way we have a relative identification with each other, relative oneness, and we have a relative difference because we all have individual features and individual natures. But that's not achintya at all. Why call it achintya? But as soon as you say there's an absolute identification and an absolute difference, then you come, and they both exist at the same time. That becomes a jhincha. That's, how is that possible? When we try to explain it, we end up explaining it by making it relative. Well, we're all individuals eternally, but we share the same qualities and minute quantity. That's not a jhincha. Is that a jhincha? That's not a jhincha at all. That's completely comprehensible and completely understandable and completely logical, which tells us that it's not the whole story. If you come up with a perfectly conceivable, understandable, logical, reasonable explanation of something that you say on the same at the same time is inconceivable and beyond logic, beyond comprehension, then your explanation must not be giving it in total. You're simplifying it. You're really, what you're giving is an analogy of it rather than it. You understand?
Yeah. Is that sentence? Sorry.
What you're really giving is an analogy of what you're describing rather than describing the thing itself. So if I say the thing itself is inconceivable, but it's like this, then the it's like this is really just an analogy. It's just a simile. It's not the actual, you're not describing the actual thing. Because the actual thing is inconceivable.
Means the scientists to know something, then they just give the name.
Yes, something like that. Like. Something. So we have some idea of this absolute identity and absolute differentiation that we have between us and God, between us and each other, between us and nature. But we really don't. It's something that obviously needs to be experienced. And it's something, once it's experienced, cannot be adequately communicated to others. Even materially, we have this sort of thing. How do you adequately communicate mango taste to somebody else? Or any experience. I mean, how do you adequately communicate an experience?
If the other person doesn't have the same experience...
You can't. You can't. You can point to it. You can, you know... But really, the other person is getting an analogy, not the experience. You follow? If I've had an experience that you haven't had, and I describe my experience to you, what you're understanding is an analogy of that experience. But you're not actually understanding the experience. You can only understand an experience by experiencing it. There's just, that's even true materially, for anything. So what to speak if we're talking about the spiritual? Therefore, by the way, and I didn't make this point in the class itself, but the only way to really understand God is by experience. We cannot really understand God just through logic. And I was just reading this point being made by a Christian theologian. I thought it was such a well-made point. That he said that people try to explain the existence of God through logic and argument and pointing at nature. He said, but the best way to understand God is just to pray to God and say, please reveal yourself to me. He said, because God is not an algorithm. He's not a formula. He's not a mathematical formula. He's not an object. He's a person. And if the best way to get to know a person is to meet them. If I want to know whether or not you exist, the best way I can know whether or not you exist is to meet you, not to be given logical arguments why you exist. Does that make sense? If I want to explain to you that, you know, I have a son, and I try to give you logical arguments as to why I have a son and show you evidence that I have a son, that's not nearly as convincing as if you meet my son. Here he is. So the main way that we're going to understand Krishna is by meeting him. And the main way we meet him is simply asking him, please reveal yourself to me. Jagannatha Swami Nayanapatagani Pavati. This is the prayers of the devotees. Ekakshi Drishya, please let me experience you. Of course, for the neophyte, our experience of God may be more indirect. But we do get practical experiences of the existence of God. And those are much, much, much more convincing than any logical or intellectual argument. Anything else? Yes?
This moment, you mentioned it during the class regarding these 100,000 spheres. Whatever you look for under the microscope or any, you immediately see just a little bit through the channels.
Magnified.
Just a little bit. You see so many different scratching, this, that. They're not at all the same.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. That is probably like that.
They look from outside the same, like a little bit just closer and not at all the same.
I mean, I know in criminal forensics, they can tell which gun shot a particular bullet. They can narrow it down to a specific gun. And those guns are all made in the factory, and the bullets are made in the factory. But they can say for sure, this bullet was shot by this, not just this kind of gun, but this particular gun. So, yeah, they must be able to have some way of telling that. So that even objects, that it's just impossible. Which tells us something, I mean, really interesting about the nature of Krishna. What is Krishna's nature? How much he likes variety. Again, he seems to like variety far more than is useful. This evolutionary idea that everything is useful is definitely not the way Krishna exists. Definitely. Krishna does not create and maintain things simply on the platform of utility. This is not how he works at all. He also works on the platform of beauty, and relationship, and fun. You know, if we try to use nature just in a utilitarian way, we're definitely missing the vast majority of Krishna's mood, even in the material nature. What utility is it to have each screw a little different? I mean, how does that value is that? Anything else? Yes.
One question about the beginning of the class, this materialistic things. I get sometimes very confused. In the world, there are lots of yoga classes, spirituality organizations, and things like that. And sometimes they are really expensive. And this sometimes also say that. When you are ready for something, you will get the money. If you really want something, God will send you. And I'm thinking, if you like want to go on some of these courses, is that materialistic thinking? Like, I really want to go on this class, and should they be? Should the price will be like? Do you understand what I mean?
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying. So, is it materialistic to want to take a class that will improve our life?
Yes.
In general?
Yes.
Could be and it could not be. It depends. You know, why do you want to improve your life? Is the real question. Do you want to improve your life because that way you'll be a more expert manipulator of the material energy for your own purposes? Or do you want to improve your life so you'll be able to do better service for the Lord? That's the question. So that's the first question. What do you want it for? I remember many, many years ago reading about this man who did a lot of natural healing. And he was able to heal one person of a very serious disease. But he also gave him lifestyle suggestions. You should change your diet. He said, I've healed you, but you need to do these things to stay healed. So the man didn't. And again, he got sick. And when he went back to the healer said, what do you want to be healed for? What's your purpose in wanting to be healthy? He said, if you want to be healthy so you can be selfish and exploitive, you'll not be able to make. He said, the work I've done for you will not stay. He said, I won't be able to get to help you be permanently well. So what do you want to take a class for? And that's not such an easy thing. Oh, yeah, I want to do it for Krishna. You know, one has to be very introspective and honest. To what extent do I really want to do this for Krishna? Then, if you're reasonably sure that you want to do it for Krishna, at least 60%, maybe not 100%, at least if it's more than 50% that you want to do it for Krishna, then the question is this really going to help me with my service? Is this really going to improve my service? And some classes will and some classes won't. And some classes will improve your service, but they wouldn't improve my service. And that's another thing. I mean, I remember many years ago when someone offered me that I could get free classes. Normally they were $2,000. But that they would give it to me for free. I said, why? And he said, well, you're a devotee of Krishna, and I'm sure that if I let you attend for free, I'll get some good karma. And then I asked some senior devotees that I trusted, you know, would this be worth it? Because even though I didn't have to pay, it was still my time and my effort and my energy. And I said, is this going to be valuable for my service? And all of them said, oh yes, this is something very useful and very helpful. I said, is there going to be anything opposed to Krishna consciousness? They said, no, nothing. And they were right, it was very useful and very helpful. But, you know, sometimes we go to classes and it's a complete waste of time and energy. And you're just like, what did I learn this for? This was just stupid. Then as far as your second point, I see this as another point, as to what about people who teach, well, whatever you want will just come to you if you want it enough. So that's true. However, when you're talking about karma, it may not come to you without work immediately. So what we get in this world is the result of our desire and our karma. You can think of your karma like money. You have a certain amount of like karma coins in your bank account. And you may be in debt also. Some people have, you know, negative karma coins in their account.
It's almost everyone. If you are born in this country, you have already like $2,000 when you are born.
Yeah, I did that. So all of us have some, you know, our good karma and our bad karma. But it's not all mixed together. It's like we have many, many, many different accounts. So you have karma coins for health, you have karma coins for wealth, you have karma coins for relationships, for all different things. And they don't cancel each other out. Good karma doesn't cancel out bad karma at all. It doesn't work like that. And then you have your desires. So let's say you really desire to have a wonderful, loving relationship, but you don't have the karma coins for a wonderful, loving relationship. So then if you meditate on that, if you meditate, wow, I found the most handsome prince. You know, he's an actual prince of a country, and he has 10 billion euros, and he's loving and romantic and heroic, and he's going to come and marry me. But you only have 2 karma coins in your bank account for relationships. Well, you can't get that. Now, what you can get is you can get advice from the super soul as to how to increase the karma coins in your relationship account. But if the difference between your desire and your karma coins is very great, then you may have to wait till another lifetime before you can have amassed enough karma coins to get that relationship. So in this lifetime, you might have no relationship at all. In the meantime, you're busy amassing your relationship, good karma, because super soul is giving you the instruction. Be nice to this person, and be nice to this person, and help this person, and be kind to this person, and be selfless with this person. And if you do all that, then you're building up your good relationship karma. And it, you know, if you really want a prince, a billionaire prince, then it may even take you 5 lifetimes of building up your good karma before you get that. But eventually, yes, you will get that. And if you meditate on something you already have the good karma for, then you may get it immediately. It's like if you want something and you go to the bank and there's your karma, then you may get it immediately. So they're correct, but they're not correct that you just manifest everything in 2 minutes. And therefore you'll find the people who teach this also teach a lot about surrender, and they also teach a lot about behaving properly. I mean, with money, you know the main way that we get wealth. Does anybody know the main way of getting wealth? Karmically? It's not hard work. It's charity. The main way that you build up karma coins for becoming wealthy is to be charitable. I find it very interesting that some of the richest people on this planet, like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, they've each pledged to give away the majority of their wealth to charity during their lifetime and in their will. And you know what's going to happen next life. They're going to be again very, very, very rich. This is reasonable. If I give you food and I give you more than you need and you hoard it all, I'm not likely to give it to you again. But if I give you more than you need and you share it, then I'm likely to give it to you again. So this is the way you, whatever you want to get, you have to give that thing. That's the way karma works. Give whatever you want to get. You want to get wealth? Give away wealth. You want to get people being kind to you? Be kind to them. You want someone to take care of you? Take care of people. You want to be healthy? Use your body nicely and help others with their health. So it's not, you can't just meditate on it. You know, if I've been a greedy, stingy miser for the last 100 lifetimes and I meditate on wealth, I don't have the karma coins to get wealth. It's just not there. And then again, Krishna will give me instruction. Give in charity. And you'll look at it. I only have 10 kunas in my bank account. How could I give charity? Do it anyway. You know, give charity even when it hurts a little. Or give charity of your time. Or give charity of something that equals money. Does that make sense to you? And you'll find the people who teach this idea of manifesting, they also teach proper behavior. It's quite interesting. They have to. They can't just teach sit down and meditate on a red jaguar. They also teach things like forgiveness and kindness and surrender. Like that. Now, of course, when it comes to bhakti, then we start operating under a completely different realm. When you operate on the platform of bhakti, you don't really get things based so much on what's in your karma coin account. Because the main thing we're asking Krishna to manifest is bhakti. At least theoretically, when we're chanting Hare Krishna, that's what we're asking for. We may not mean it, but that's another thing. But we're saying basically over and over again, my Lord, I want to serve you. Oh, my Lord, oh, my energy of the Lord, please engage me in your service. I want to serve you. I want to love you. I want to serve you. We may not really be saying that in our heart, but we are saying that. And we're asking Krishna to manifest that in our lives. So because we're asking Krishna to manifest that in our lives, he's going to play with everything else so that that will happen. So if we say, Krishna, I really want to love you and serve you, and I also want, you know, the $250,000 BMW, you know, he may or may not give it, even if we had the karma coins for it. He might say, okay, well, you can afford this, but if you can afford this karmically, but if you get this karmically, it really may mess up this other thing you're asking for. So what do you want more? You know, do you want your relationship with me more, or do you want the car more? If you want the car more, okay, but now it's going to delay our relationship. Do you want our relationship more? Okay, then can you forget about the car? Because it's not going to work. It's true like this even with human relationships, isn't it? If you have a relationship with another human, and that other human, you know, wants to go to the beach, and you want to go to the mountains, so you may forego where you want to go because your relationship is more important. Yes, am I correct? Yeah. So Krishna is asking us really over and over and over and over again, what's more important to you? These things you want are our relationship. And if the things we want are not going to hinder our relationship, then Krishna will give them. Why not? We've earned them, we want them, he loves us, and if they'll help our relationship, or even if they're not going to help it, if they won't hinder it. We as humans give people who we love all sorts of things and facility, as long as it doesn't hinder our relationship. Yes? Does that make sense? But then you're operating under a completely different situation. If you're operating under the law of karma, it's pretty mechanical. And even if you're a demon, if you have the right amount of karma coins in the right area of your life, you get it. Of course, then Krishna may have to trick you to take it away from you because you're causing so much trouble with it. But when you're dealing with Krishna, it becomes very, very personal. Such is perhaps the reason why people today don't get married. The rate of marriage is going down. Because when you marry somebody, one thing you have to do is you have to compromise for the sake of your relationship. You can't just go and do whatever you want. This is also, I think, why people don't want to have children. Because it's even more extreme with children, because little children are not reasonable. You can't reason with a two-month-old baby and say, you know, well, can I get some sleep now? There's no negotiating. Yeah. And when you're married and you have children, you have to sacrifice your own desires for the sake of the relationship. You absolutely must. There's just no alternative, except, I guess, leaving. You could murder them, you know. You could leave, and you could put your children up for adoption or something. But if you want to maintain the relationship, you have to. You have to give up things that you want and you've earned. You must. So this is our, when we're dealing with Krishna, we're also dealing like that. If we value our relationship, we'll accept some things that normally we wouldn't have accepted, and we'll reject some things that we normally would have accepted. And that we may even have earned. We could say to Krishna, well, I earned this. I did the karma for it. I earned it. And you say, yeah, but if you take it, it's going to be a problem for us. And Krishna may give us things that we haven't earned also. It's not just that he takes away things that we've earned or doesn't give us things that we've earned. He also gives us things that are completely unearned. Let's say you weren't very charitable in your previous lives, and by your karma, you know you're going to be a poor person. But once you're in bhakti, you start spending money nicely in Krishna's service. So Krishna may say, well, you know, you didn't earn this through mundane charity, but you're showing me through the way you're using money in service that you can handle lots of money without becoming selfish. You know, here's €1 million to take care of. Krishna does that too. Gives his devotees things that they haven't earned at all, because they use it nicely in service. So it works in both directions. And Krishna, of course, may take away suffering that we've earned. You know, that's what we want him to take away. It's like, Krishna, please take away the suffering that I've earned. We want it just in that direction. Krishna, please take away the suffering that I have rightfully earned, and please give me opulences in bhakti that I haven't earned. Hare Krishna.
Pure devotion.
Yes, pure devotion. But it can work the other way. Krishna can take away opulences that you've earned, and he can give you suffering that you haven't earned. So Krishna is starting to give the devotee both suffering and enjoyment that's not earned. He's looking at the relationship rather than the earnings. If that's what we really want. If we don't really want that, then that's another question. And when the devotees get the relationship with Krishna, like Dhruva Maharaj, then they feel that all of this material happiness and distress that they've earned has no value and no meaning anymore. Does that make sense? Again, we feel this way even in our human relationships. Like the Taj Mahal, it was built by Shah Jahan for Mumtaz. And Mumtaz, she was a queen. But when Shah Jahan was exiled, she went with him into exile, like Sita went with Ram into exile. That she considered her relationship with her husband was more important than any of the things that she had earned. And he was so moved by this that when she died, he built this huge memorial to her. So this is even there in human relationships, that we will value our loving relationships more than the time that we have earned. You know, I've earned some time for myself. I worked hard all day. I have time for recreation, but now my child is sick, and that's more important than the time that I earned. Is that okay? We should end now. Yes, we'll take one more.
Regarding sati, you know, it's apparently how previously people give much more to the relation with husband and wife. Wife consciously doesn't appreciate to live without. I mean,
yes.
I don't know if for in all cases, but that's the basic.
That was the basic.
That wife is so sublime that she.
They didn't even want to live anymore.
Yeah, she wanted to follow him.
Yes. So even if the...
They go together to another planet, heaven planet.
Is it? Exactly, yes. So the woman was thinking that even though I have uncollected, earned karma on this planet, that that's not important. What's important is my relationship. And she jumps in the fire to follow the husband. We've seen that also in the Bhagavatam for a man to his wife with Pururava and urgency. Where as soon as urgency left, he didn't want to live anymore.
His motivation was a little bit low.
What?
His motivation is a little bit more low than this one.
Well, we think of it that way. We think that the motivation of the woman for the man is higher than the motivation of the man for the woman, but I don't know about that. When it comes to bhakti, I don't think that's true. If we want to look materially, yes. Okay.
Yeah, speaking materially.
Speaking materially, yes. But speaking from a platform of bhakti, Lord Kapila Dev tells Devahuti that any woman who thinks that her husband is the source of her wealth and her children and her happiness is going to her death like the deer is being called by the hunter. And Lakshmi Devi, you know, she rejects all other men and marries Narayan. And Rukmini says any woman who wants to have a husband that's just a bag of skin filled with, you know, blood and decorated with mustaches and filled up with stool and urine is a fool. So from the platform of bhakti, to have that kind of devotion to a man is just as stupid as having that kind of devotion to a woman. It's both a stupid, useless waste of time. They're just going to get you another material body. And what is the point? You know, if your husband or your wife or your children or your uncle or your aunt is a pure devotee, then that's another interesting thing. Then sometimes your attachment to a pure devotee relative can liberate you. So when Subhari Muni's 50 wives, they were attached to him, but he became a pure devotee, then they also became liberated. But that's another thing. But anyway, we do see this also with some of the men, that they're so attached to their wife that when their wife leaves, when she effectively dies, all they're doing yajnas to go to her planet and be with her again. So this is yes, but Pete, that we see this mood. I mean, it has the wrong object. You know, the object is mistaken, but the mood is correct. That my relationship is so valuable that nothing else is valuable. Nothing else is valuable. And I'm willing to sacrifice anything else that's valuable for the sake of this relationship because the relationship is so fulfilling. I don't need anything else. Materially, that won't work. You'll sacrifice everything for relationship. The relationship will not fulfill you. But when you sacrifice everything for Krishna, you know, Krishna fulfills. Because you can't imitate. Please don't try to imitate this artificially. Please, please don't try to imitate this artificially. Please, please, please do not try to imitate this artificially. Doesn't work. Please don't do that. It makes a mess out of everything. I'm going to sacrifice everything right now for Krishna, and you don't really know what you're doing. You don't really feel that way, and you just do something stupid, and you break your health, and you become bitter and angry, and then you'll hate me for giving this class. Yes, Prabhu.
It is the reason also why in this Gaupo made this search. Was the happiest nation in the world, and most poor, like Bangladesh,
yes.
First, because people are happy with the relationship. They don't have almost nothing. They live. They have one euro daily income,
yes.
But they're happy.
Yes, yes.
They satisfy the relationship.
That's a very good point. Yeah, that's really what makes us happy. If we have loving relationships, then other things are not very important. They really aren't. That's just the essence of things. But people nowadays are renouncing loving relationships. They're not renouncing sense gratification. They're not becoming brahmacharis and sannyasis. Hare Krishna. But they're renouncing loving relationships. They're renouncing responsibility. They're renouncing sacrifice. Of course, you can't renounce sacrifice. you end up sacrificing in another way. You sacrifice your happiness, you sacrifice your health. But people, they don't want to. I don't want to take care of a spouse. I don't want to take care of a child. I don't want to. I want to just do whatever I want, whenever I want, however I want. I want to use all my money to buy what I want. You know, when you're married, you can't do that. You can't. You can't just say, I'm going to use the money. Even the husband can't do that. It won't be a happy marriage. If the husband just uses all of his money to buy whatever he wants, you know, it won't work. You have to work with another person and compromise and agree and have something in a relationship. But yeah, this is what we really want. And ultimately, we should be doing this with the Lord.
Yeah? Just a small question regarding the sati. Was it considered proper because it's in a way a suicide?
Well, that's a deep question. That's kind of a shoo, he just took us to another realm. I can just say very briefly, there are authorized forms of suicide in the Shastra. Mm. Frankly, every society recognizes that certain kinds of suicide are glorious. There was a plane many, many years ago that crashed into the Potomac River in America, in Washington, D.C. in the winter. So the water was cold, and as we know, temperature is our second physiological need. Our first physiological need is air. Our second physiological need is not water, it's temperature. So if you're in very cold water, you have, what is it, half an hour, 45 minutes that you can live. So it was very quick. They had to do a very fast rescue because all these people fell into the freezing water. It was the middle of the winter. It was ice in the water. And in that fast time, they couldn't mobilize that many rescue helicopters. So they bring in, also the people were all in one place and it was so cold they couldn't swim. So they had a rescue helicopter and it was throwing down, what do they call it? One of those life-saving, like a big donut, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right?
So they're throwing it down, and one man would catch it, and he would give it to somebody else. And again, the man would catch it, because he was right under the helicopter. And again, he would give it to somebody else. And again, the man would catch it. And again, he would give it to somebody else. And by the time it came time for him to go up, he had died. When he was the only one left, he had died. So is that a nice suicide or not? What do you think? So that kind of suicide is, it was suicide. At least he was risking it. He didn't know. I'm sure at a certain point he knew. I'm sure it got to a point that he knew. If I give this away again, I'm not going to make it.
But I've heard also instances where someone would, like, also in the sea, and someone would help others, and through helping others, live longer.
Sometimes that happens.
Like this.
Sometimes it happens. But my point is that he was glorified all over the country, maybe all over the world. So we glorify that kind of suicide. So there's certain kinds. Or, you know, in a war, somebody rushes in front of the bullets to save, and they know they may be killed.
The Dichimuni.
Yeah, the Dichimuni. That's an example. Also, I don't know if I should say this, but it's in the Bhagavatam. The Prabhupada says glorious death is once your body is useless for service, you just go out in the forest and die without anybody knowing. Instead of dying surrounded by your family, he said that is a glorious death. Specifically in relation to the Vanaprastha. The Vanaprastha is told if your body gets useless for service, you can just fast. Fasting till death in that situation is considered acceptable. I was reading an interesting article about assisted suicide. It was saying if people want to die, all they need to do is stop eating. They don't need to take some drug or like that. And it said the benefit of fasting until death is it gives you time to reflect on what you're doing. Because most people who try to commit suicide, who don't succeed. The vast majority of them say that the moment they did whatever it was to kill themselves, they regretted it and wanted to live. So most people, if they say, okay, I'm going to fast until death, they won't complete it. Because as things are progressing, they'll say, wait a minute, I really don't want to. But, you know, if the body's going to die, I mean, Sri Ram Maharaj was just talking about this, how one devotee who was diagnosed with terminal cancer just went to Vrindavan and fasted until death. One devotee I know very well, she went to the Vrindavan hospice and she was dying of cancer. And at one point she just stopped eating and drinking. You know, and someone else was writing me and saying, you know, she can't do this. I said, let her do whatever she wants. You know, she's in Vrindavan, she's dying anyway. And frankly, Prabhupada stopped eating at the end. That was what he did. So that can also be there. But it can't be, you know, it has to be because the body's finished anyway. It can't be just, you know, I have too many debts to pay, or I did something embarrassing and I don't want any, you know, I'm too embarrassed to live anymore. A big reason people commit suicide is they do something that's just so humiliating. But that is extremely sinful. That is extremely sinful, to try to get out of your karmic reactions by destroying your body. The reaction for that is horrendous. But yeah, there are certain sacrificing your body for some higher purpose, or intentionally, like the yogis could leave their body, they just meditated on fire. That's another sanctioned suicide. But you have to be a yogi to do that. You can't, you know, I couldn't do that. I couldn't just sit here and meditate on fire and burn up my body. Does that make sense? But the yogis, that's what Sati did. That's why it's called the Sati rite, because that's what she did. And the yogis can do it. The yogis can leave their body at any time. But to leave your body because the material, you know, you're having some material misery that you don't want to face. We'll talk about that tonight, actually. That's like a prisoner who wants to get out of the prison by committing suicide. Doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Whatever you were destined to suffer, you know what? You're going to suffer anyway, just in the next life. Plus, you have to suffer for having destroyed your body. You know, if I owe you money, and it's too much trouble to pay you back, so I destroy my sock of cash, that doesn't eliminate my debt to you. I still owe you. One of the most interesting things I remember reading was a woman who attempted suicide and had a near-death experience. And when she left her body, she was in blackness. Everything was dark. And she had a sense that there were thousands of other souls, each isolated and in darkness. And she had this feeling, is this what you want? Actually, right after, she shot herself in the heart. And as she shot herself, she said, God, please forgive me. And that's what she accredited to what happened. So she had this sense there were all these other souls that had been isolated for thousands and thousands of years. Because if you commit suicide, you're saying, I don't want my relationships anymore. I don't want anything. So they're prevented from having them. Sometimes they have to be ghosts where they can perceive their family, but they can't interact with them. And then she thought, no, I don't want that. And then she saw light, and some higher being showed her that you have two choices. You can return to your body now and finish your life, or you can die now, stay in this state of isolation and loneliness for countless thousands of years. Then again, when you take birth, you'll have to relive your life exactly as it was until the point of your suicide, to give you the option of another choice. She said, okay, good, take me back to my body. She became a very religious person. She did a lot of preaching and teaching. She became like a minister. So who would want to commit suicide if that's what, you know, if the result of suicide is you have to spend thousands and thousands of years as a ghost, and then you have to experience everything all over again that pushed you to the suicide in the first place? You know, why bother? What a stupid choice. But there are ways of intentionally leaving your body through yoga, etc., and in certain circumstances, that everybody sanctions, that everybody understands as a glorious, heroic death. So that is also there. It's just like anything. You know, like you can say, well, murder is always horrendous. Well, it isn't always. If somebody comes and is trying to murder your child and you murder that person, then that's not horrible at all. So there's you know, almost everything that's horrible and sinful is not horrible and sinful in certain circumstances. The only absolutely horrible thing is to take pleasure in hurting others. That's always absolutely horrible. To harm others or yourself for your own personal selfishness. And suicide is one of the most extreme forms of that. That for your own selfishness, you're destroying the property of God and you're hurting, you know, everyone who loves you. Just for your own selfishness. So it's a very, very extreme form of evil. But that's the only thing that's always forbidden. But the actual form of what you do, that's very relative. Does that make sense to anyone? Behaviors are not absolutely good or bad. They can't be. I mean, Prabhupada talks about how there can be professional Bhagavatam reciters who are harming themselves and their audience. Am I correct? You could say, well, Bhagavatam, that's absolutely good. No. There are professional kirtaneers who are Prabhupada will say, taking their audience to hell. He said they and their audience may be going to hell. And we're not saying that anyone who gets money for kirtan is going to hell. We're not saying. Prabhupada sometimes wouldn't take certain preaching engagements unless they paid. So we're not, it's not the question of taking money, but it's the mentality. So even something like chanting, even something like Bhagavatam, can actually be evil, depending on who you are. And something like jumping in a fire may be a great thing, depending on who you are. That depends. Okay, we really, really should end now. Hare Krishna. Shiva Prabhupada.